For the Meat Poultry Podcast, I'm Ryan McCarthy, Digital Media Associate Editor. In this episode of the podcast, we talk with Ryan Glenn and Michael Annis, who are partners in the Food and Agribusiness Practice Group of the law firm Hush Blackwell. We cover a variety of ongoing legal topics, including how COVID-19 compares to other periods of agribusiness law. Then Ryan and Michael discuss the difficulties of litigating these cases for both the companies and the employees. They also walk us through some of the early procedures they have seen with meat processing cases during the pandemic, and what the ongoing Safe to Work Act might look like if it is passed through the U.S. Congress. It's an overarching look at what employers now face during the pandemic, so please listen to the podcast and let us know what you think. Ryan and Michael, share a little background with our audience about your professional experiences with food, agribusiness, and meat processing.
Sure. I'll take it first. I'm a partner in the food and agribusiness strategic business unit within the firm. I office out of Omaha, presently in Iowa, though, at my home, of course. But I devote most of my time and experience to a variety of civil litigation matters on behalf of the firm, ranging from, you know, traditional breach of contract matters to trade secret misappropriation cases. And those can, you know, kind of touch on all different aspects of the food and agribusiness industry. Mike mentioned briefly before our couple of different initiatives that are within Food and Ag, including the Animal Health and Production Initiative. I'm also a member of that, in addition to the Food and Regulatory and Safety Initiative. So for that, we kind of help our clients navigate the legal framework and regulatory entities that can be applicable there, such as FDA, USDA, things of that nature.
So like Ryan, I guess you'd call me a food and agribusiness lawyer. Perhaps Ryan, you know that several years ago, Hush Blackwell started organizing its attorneys by legal practice area, instead of by legal practice area like real estate or corporate or litigation. We separated our lawyers into what we call specialty business units. And that is, we have like-minded attorneys that focus on specific industries and their unique legal needs. Since we've done that, and again, this has been almost 10 years ago, I have been the lead in our animal health and animal production practice group. And I guess you could say that finishing yards, stockyards, packers, they all fall within the gambit of what we attempt to provide services to in animal health and production.
Okay.
My personal practice focuses on trial work. With an emphasis on intellectual property, I do some class action defense works, generally in relation to false advertising cases and things of that nature.
Right. Well, with so much changing in the industry the last 6 months, Michael or Ryan, I know with all your focus on a variety of parts of the industry, how does COVID kind of compare to other times of your legal experience?
I guess I'll start here. Honestly, as it relates to the practice of law, it's a lot the same, but there's very unique legal and procedural issues that COVID has brought to bear. By way of example, I'm a trial lawyer, and COVID has impacted the court system just like other businesses where there are gatherings of people. It's really slowed down the litigation process. It's hard to get to jury, right, on any particular action that's been filed. By way of example, I have an arbitration hearing that's set to begin October 5. We're going to do it by Zoom. I've never done that before. And so there are these unique things that have cropped up, but things I think that we're all going to get accustomed to and will adapt. I think that there are some unique issues that have come up with COVID-19 that I haven't seen before in my practice, like executive orders requiring businesses to remain open and operating. Some of the various legislative actions that we've seen both at the state level and at the federal level that are particularly aimed at COVID-19 related issues. But by and large, it's practicing law.
Right. Ryan, anything to add?
I would largely just echo Mike's comments on that. I mean, the logistical challenges that we've faced here in the last 6 months as a result of COVID have definitely been interesting, but we've kind of dove in head first and been able to adapt on our feet like trial lawyers usually have to. And so it's definitely been a challenge we've been able to accept and work with.
Right. And Ryan, I wanted to tackle that a little bit with you, and then Michael, you can add on. How has COVID-19 affected your jobs as lawyers investigating lawsuits? I'm imagining a lot of times, I mean, I know there's a lot of phone work or video conferencing work some of the time, but now so much of it not being able to talk in person so much has got to make it challenging.
Yeah, I have definitely received many more video conference invites in the last 6 months than I usually would for, you know, whether it be fact-finding investigations with the client. Obviously, we haven't been able to do on-site inspections that we traditionally would have. And so making arrangements for those to be done virtually is one thing that has impacted our practice in investigating lawsuits. But otherwise, I mean, it's, again, it's largely the same. I mean, we still, you know, hit the ground running once a lawsuit is even thought of and do our fact finding that's necessary, and then figure out what the law is applicable at the time that we need to review for our client.
Yeah, I really have nothing to add to what Ryan has said. It's a lot the same, but different.
Gotcha. I was curious for your guys' experience. Some of the material you sent us showed examples of recent meat industry litigation and stuff that's in the process of it going through the courts. Can you explain why some of these cases will be so hard to litigate, especially from the employee side, Michael?
I think that I'll let Ryan take the first crack at that.
Yeah, we've reviewed several different state legislation that has been passed so far. I think right now you're kind of in the range of about a dozen states that have enacted some form of legislation on COVID-related issues. The ones that we have paid particular attention to seem to be providing significant protections on the employer side. And so that is going to be difficult for an employee to meet the necessary burden of proof in order to, you know, show that not only were they exposed to COVID-19 at the workplace and not somewhere else in the community, but many of these state laws have elements of actual malice, reckless disregard, and the employees are going to have to show that they are not following the guidance that was either issued by the federal government or the local public health entities at the time that they were exposed to COVID-19. And so that's going to present a significant challenge for many of the plaintiffs in these types of cases.
I can jump in there and I guess take kind of two steps back. I think what we're seeing is, if you have an employee that's exposed to a disease process at the workplace, in the scope and course of their employment, we have workers' compensation laws and special what we call industrial courts to handle those, really become an administrative claim. What Ryan's talking about is when and where an employee might be able to operate outside of that workers' compensation complex and file a civil case. That when we use civil case, we're meaning a case that's actually filed at the courthouse, as opposed to an action that would be filed within an administrative agency like any particular state's workers' compensation bureau or industrial courts. I don't think that any of the legislation that we've seen, either from a state level that has actually been enacted, or the SAFE Act, which I think we'll get to a bit later, there's no indication that those statutes are intended to in any way, shape, or form impact an employee's ability to pursue claims in workers' compensation or industrial court. They're really intended to put a high bar into if the employee attempts to get out of workers' compensation and go to the civil court system and seek things like punitive damages, things of that nature that aren't otherwise available at the workers' compensation level, that there are these additional burdens of proof and perhaps even prohibitions against suit that we're starting to see from the legislative side.
So just so I got it right, so the employee would they be forfeiting their workers' compensation at this point if they're trying to go into the civil suits, or is it something that they're trying to tack on top of a workers' compensation?
Usually it's an either-or proposition, okay. And every state is different. And I have to give full disclosure, I'm no work comp attorney. I've never practiced in that field. But in general, states where I have lived and practices generally have a bar that is provided for an employee to sue outside of workers' compensation. That there are some states like Illinois where it's the employee's choice as to where to file the claim, but that the employer always has the ability to immediately remove a civil action from state court system into workers' compensation, or the employer can waive that right. It is completely state by state dependent. But in general, I think that the comp remedy will always be there and available to the employees. They might have burdens there to establish that they did in fact, obtain the disease process, get COVID, and were exposed to it at the workplace. And that might provide some layer, even at the comp level, of being a difficult step for the employee to get through, because who's to say that they weren't exposed at the Hy-Vee, right? Or at the Exxon station, or at church. I think that it will be a difficult proposition for them. They can certainly prove those types of things in exposure by circumstantial evidence. By way of example, if on day one there was no one at the workplace that was COVID-19 positive, and on day 20 there were 35 coworkers, that there is a likelihood that if they're not, you know, case zero, right? Right. That their exposure came at work.
Okay. Ryan, anything to add on that? I know we covered a lot of ground there, so.
Yeah, no, I don't think so. It is definitely going to be interesting to see this all play out in the states that have enacted legislation, just because they are, again, the ones that we've reviewed explicitly saying that the employee still has the right to pursue workers' compensation claims, but then the question becomes, well, how does that work out in the long run? And so it will be definitely interesting to see it play out.
Hear from the experts in the industry on the Meat and Poultry Podcast. The latest news, trends, technologies, and people in the world of meat and poultry processing delivered right into your ears. Listen every Friday and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Yeah, and that kind of goes to another question I had before we get into the Safe to Work Act that you guys had talked about and wrote about when you emailed us. I wanted to talk a little bit about the audience and why federal court will be the place where a lot of these will be settled instead of state courts. I know you guys wrote about that. Why is that going to be the case?
Well, I'll tell you, I don't know that we know that that's the case yet. So I think that the SAFE Act, if it is enacted, it just now is legislation that's percolating through the halls of Congress. If it becomes law, it will provide a basis for removal of actions, particularly for defendants. So if plaintiff sues defendant, the plaintiff employee sues employer defendant in state court, can employer then remove that matter to federal court to try to get a more friendly forum to litigate the dispute and perhaps prevent the dispute based upon the federal legislation. So if we do have SAFE, enacted and signed into law by the president. Depending upon what that looks like when it gets to that stage, it may provide a vehicle for an employee to bring the action originally in federal court. Our federal court system, they're courts of limited jurisdiction. And so you either have to find a federal cause of action, right, a federal statute to sue on, or that you have to be able to prove diversity of citizenship between the plaintiff and the defendant. You're probably not going to be able to do that in an employer-employee relationship. So the statute itself could provide the basis for an employee to file an action originally in federal court, or it also might be able to provide that basis for the defendant employer to remove a state case to federal court. In that situation, then we probably will see the federal court system dominate in ultimately deciding a number of these issues. And just to throw gasoline onto the fire, all of these statutory systems, both from a state perspective and federal, we're in uncharted waters here. And there is no question that this is going to provide a bar or an impediment to the plaintiff class, right? To those people that are complainers, the people that file a lawsuit. Mm-hmm. They're going to, and their lawyers will challenge the constitutional efficacy of these statutes. So it will be some time before I think all this gets sorted out as to, you know, by way of example with the SAFE Act, what provides the federal Congress to legislate on the issue that is local in nature? I think that they will cite to the Commerce Clause. That's a typicality of trying to establish that they are the right folks to legislate in the area. Will the plaintiff's bar take that line down? Absolutely not. We'll see fights for a long time to come on this.
And just to kind of piggyback on what Mike just said, even if the Safe to Work Act does not gain any traction and move forward, we already are seeing in the pending litigation that's on file in a few different states, defendants that are choosing to file notices of removal into federal court from a pending state law action on the basis that they were ordered by the president in order to stay open under an executive order, citing to the Defense Production Act. And so you're already seeing that limited subject matter jurisdiction element being utilized by defendants in order to get into federal court.
Right.
And we can't say whether or not it's going to work.
Right.
We haven't seen any of these percolate through. I assume that in those cases that the plaintiff's lawyers will argue that the case needs to be remanded back to state court, that the removal was improper, and that those either the president's executive order or the Defense Production Act didn't provide a basis for charging federal courts with jurisdiction over those types of disputes.
Right. And as you guys just laid out, it's all very preliminary right now, and it's hard to see where it's going to go. But I was interested that we were starting to get a few fines coming down from OSHA and other places like that. And I was wondering if you've seen that, if that's going to have any impact on legal cases, or how those fines usually impact situations when it comes to like a workers' compensation thing in the past, how that kind of ties into all the other legal things that are going on when OSHA decides to come in at the same time.
Yeah. We do not know the intricate particulars of either of the situations that have come down in September related to JBS or Smithfield related to OSHA. But I mean, obviously the rulings that have come down will be a data point for anybody to look at going forward into the future from both sides of the table. And so, you know, from the employer side, you should and can certainly look at these decisions as a means to see what OSHA is thinking should be required, what is required, what are in the guidelines and publications that have been set out there to the general public, because I mean, rest assured, everybody else is going to be looking at those as well. And so it's certainly a data point that should be looked at going forward.
Yeah, and I think to your question, what impact will it have on ongoing legal cases? Well, in cases like negligence or nuisance, the types of actions that will be alleged by an injured worker or somebody that is a customer that alleges that they've contracted coronavirus by entering into somebody's premises, you'll always look to the standard of care, the reasonableness of the activities of the entity that owned or operated the premises. And guidelines issued by folks like OSHA will provide kind of at least a stake in the ground for the parties to look to say, this is what is reasonable. This is what means that you're in substantial compliance with any particular governmental regulation. So yeah, I think that even though it is an OSHA-based decision and ruling, it can have impact on helping set the parameters of what a reasonable employer or business owner should do before having people invited onto the premises.
Right. And that's kind of what I wanted to wrap up, because it's at this early stage, it's kind of hard to get a lot of legal stuff sorted out right now. Everything's such a preliminary process. So I did want to ask you guys, though, what for the outlook of companies, and we look a lot of times at small and medium-sized companies, what are they going to have to do to maintain a level of safety and protection for their employees with all of this going on? What are you guys going to have to see until we can, you know, obviously have more therapeutics and treatments that are more readily available and vaccines whenever that'll actually happen? So,
yeah, I mean, I think first and foremost, education and more education on the part of the companies that are in this area is key. And I mean, in particular, you know, not only looking at decisions that come down from entities like OSHA, but also paying attention to what's going on in your state through the state legislature, as well as to any local public health guidance measures that are in place, and kind of looking at that as a whole, whether you are already having your employees come back to work, if you never close down, you know, there's all sorts of return to work type checklists and toolkits that are available that can help in that area. With respect to, you know, how this looks for the foreseeable future, to your point, I think the precautions and the education is going to, I mean, be present in everybody's lives for the foreseeable future. I mean, even just looking at the draft of the Safe to Work Act, it defines that a coronavirus exposure action is one that occurred between December 1, 2019, all the way up through 2024. And so in that situation, if, you know, if a company doesn't have a precaution in place on September 30th, 2024, they're probably going to be in trouble if somebody gets COVID-19 at that point in time. So unfortunately, it looks like the precautions are here to stay for sure in this area.
Shameless plug. As soon as COVID-19 started impacting all of our lives, Hush Blackwell actually launched the COVID-19 response team to help provide insights to businesses as they were addressing the challenges, frankly, that fell out of the coronavirus outbreak. We have one such toolkit that can be found at hushblackwell.com/coronavirus that can be used to aid employers in the process of returning to work safely.
Sounds good. Well, I'm glad you finished with those two things. And Ryan, especially, that was really interesting about how this is, at least from your guys' perspective, is a long ways off still, if they're going to continue putting stuff like that in legislation for 2024. So Anything else you guys would like to add before we get off? I really appreciate your insights on this. It's good to get this perspective after we've gotten through the hectic spring and summer. So
just again, thank you for inviting us, and happy to do it anytime you need some insight into legal issues.
Yes, thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Make sure to check out the latest stories from the magazine and online at meatpoultry.com. Also follow us on social media on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, and Instagram, all by searching at Meat Poultry. And if you like what you heard, please leave a rating and review. It really helps us. All right, that's it for this time, folks. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.